As we begin this morning, I want to remind you, as we did last week, if you haven't already picked up a bulletin, go ahead and to do that there in the foyer, the lobby right there. We also email them. It's pretty much exactly the same. What you get in email is what I print out. A little bit of a quality difference, but encourage you to pick that up and look at the articles. John asked me if that was a picture of Mars. That's not Mars. Actually, that looks like the California desert. That's kind of what it looked like to me. And so, when you read the article, you'll get the connection with the desert and the wilderness. And the other thing that we mentioned last week is also in the bulletin is, if you're on Facebook, look us up on Facebook, Church of Christ on Billy Hecks Road, and like us or follow. I don't know exactly what the terminology is there. And then when things get posted on that, and I'm the one that will be posting things on that, if you think it's a good thing, hit share, because then it gets to your feed and then other people see it. And so that's a way to kind of reach out to people in the community and expose them to our faith, the faith of Jesus Christ, the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I hope you will do that. I'm flying solo for a few days this week. Beth left this morning, and she is going to spend a few days with her father up in Indiana. So she will be back Friday. I know there are things in life that people dislike, but at some level we have to do it. And I don't know everyone's career in here, and I made the mistake one time to rail against dentists when I didn't realize that a brother in Christ was a dentist. So my question is, do we have any car salesmen in the audience? To me, that is one of the worst experiences I dislike. I like the idea of new vehicle versus old vehicle that you drive around for a while. I like that idea, but I dislike the whole process. There's been times where I had to order a part for either my car or for Beth's car. And so you call a dealership up and their parts department. You go in, you pull in, and you park just to go get the part that you ordered to pay for and to walk out. And as soon as you park, what happens? It's blood in the water, and you have salesmen just look at your vehicle and rail against the vehicle and say, oh, are you here to buy a new car? Like, no, I'm just here to buy a part. But then the times when you actually have to go and to buy a vehicle, I'm not great at it. Beth is wonderful at shopping for a car because she is. If it's not the deal she likes, she just gets up and she'll walk out. And she doesn't bat an eye against it. I'm like, well, maybe we can make it work. But I hate that idea. You go in, you pick out the car that you want, and then you got to negotiate. And you sit down and they say, okay, how much do you want to have as a monthly payment? It's like, no, don't give me that. Just give me what's the total amount. That's what I want to know. How much debt totally am I going to be in? And they're like, well, give me the number. And say, okay, here's the number that I'm willing to pay. And they'll go back off to the sales manager, and they have their private conversation, which is probably not about the price of your vehicle, but about something else. And then they come back out and say, well, we can't do that, but we can do this. And they're like, no, I can't do that. How about this? And then they go back again. And it's just that back and forth thing. And then the whole time after you do come to an agreement, you drive off the lot. And when you drive off the lot, you know that you lose value as soon as the back tires cross the curb onto the main street. And you're wondering the whole time, what kind of car did I just buy? Is it going to last me 5 years, 6 years, 7 years? Is it going to break down We had a vehicle. We bought a used vehicle, and the night we drove it home, that night we had an electrical issue and the whole car stopped. The night I bought it, it did that. It's frustrating. For that reason, I go to CarMax. It's a lot easier to deal with. But you know, when you think about things like that, I think we have to conclude or understand that buying a car is not a whole lot different than someone walking into the door or through the doors of a church building for the first time. And they're looking for a church. And, you know, they come in and, you know, oftentimes there's the gauntlet that they have to pass through. You got a bunch of people lined up in the foyer, and they come through that, and everyone's saying, good morning, good morning, good morning, and hey, how can we help you, and things like that, which is good. It's good to be friendly, don't get me wrong. But they come in, and it's like, yeah, I don't know about this. Is this what I'm really looking for? Is this going to be a lemon of a church, or is this going to be the gem? What am I looking for? What is good? What do I want to find? And in that, what people do is they establish a metric, if you would, or standard to evaluate the congregation. And they use one of two standards. One is subjective, that's theirs. They say, well, are the people friendly? Is the singing good or the music good in the denominational realm? Is the preacher exciting? Are people friendly? Well, you know, all those kinds of things that people look at. But then there's God's standard. And God's standard is different. It's not so subjective. Rather, it is black and white, faithful or not faithful. In the book of Revelation, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, Jesus addresses seven churches. And in this address, he's addressing who the letter is being written to. It's the seven churches of Asia. And as you look at chapter 2 and chapter 3, we're not going to spend a lot of time there. What you have is a breakdown of congregations that were doing pretty good, a congregation that was doing horrible, and then two congregations that were doing phenomenal. And as I introduce these, I want you to ask the question of you, if you were walking into the door of that congregation, would you say, okay, this is where I want to be a member? Is this where I want to attend? The first one is in chapter 2, verse 1 through 7, and that's Ephesus. And it's the very first congregation that's mentioned, and it's the first of four in which there is a commendation and a condemnation. Now listen to what Jesus says about them. That's positive. He says, you toil, that's your work. You patiently endure. You cannot bear with those that are evil. You have not grown weary, and you hate the work of the Nicolaitans, whoever they were, and we don't really know who they were. They were someone that taught something that was false. And you look at that and say, hey, that sounds awfully good. They're workers. They endure. They do all these things that are good. And yet, what do we know about them? Jesus says, but I have this one thing against you. You've abandoned the love that you had at the first. In chapter 2 and verse 12 through 17, you have the church of Pergamum. And the positive things that I said about them come first. It says they held fast Christ's name. They didn't deny the faith. Hey, that sounds wonderful. That's where I want to be. But then you read on what Jesus condemns it for. Some held the teaching of Balaam, and some held the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Okay, so let's just move on down the road. You have the church of Thyatira. They have love, they have faith, they have service, they have patient endurance. Their latter works exceed their first works. In other words, what they do has been getting better with time. But then Jesus says, but my problem is you tolerate Jezebel, who teach the servants of Christ to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. Maybe that's not a good fit. Then there's the church of Sardis, chapter 3, verse 1 through 6. And the interesting thing about Sardis is where those other ones, Jesus starts off with a positive that ends with the negative. With Sardis, he starts with the negative and then ends with the positive. What does he say? He says, you have a reputation for life, but you are dead. Your works are incomplete. So what's so positive? Well, there's a few names that haven't soiled their garments. There's a few people there that were pure, that were doing what was right. So those four congregations, how many of you would say, hey, I want to be part of those? Probably not many. Then you have the one congregation that only received the condemnation. Laodicea, chapter 3, and verse 14 through 22. They weren't cold, they weren't hot, but what were they? They were lukewarm. Jesus wanted to vomit them from his mouth because they had this attitude that they needed nothing, that they were fine however they were, when in fact they were deathly ill and in need of change. Okay, that's not the one for me. What about the last two? The ones that only received positive from Jesus. The first one was Smyrna, back in chapter 2, verse 8 through 11. And what you find out about Smyrna is they're persecuted to the point of death. Verse 10, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. That might not be the right fit either. So we go to chapter 3 and verse 7 through 13, and you find the church of Philadelphia. And the church of Philadelphia, what you see is that they're a small congregation, and the Lord provided a small opportunity, an open door. So they're small, they're not that exciting, but they are working. So here's the question. Which one would you join? Which of those seven? How do we decide? Once again, what standards do we use? Do we use man's standards or God's standards? If we use man's standards, then none of those really excite, even though some are better than others. But when we use God's standard, this is what we see. That the local church has a purpose. And that purpose in John chapter 4 and verse 23 and 24 is to be true worshipers who will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And what we find is that God is seeking those true worshipers who will do that. What we find in God's standard is that God is looking for people that will worship Him in spirit with the right attitude and according to what He reveals in the Word. But what we also see in the New Testament is that as members of the body of Christ and the local congregation, we have other works that we got to do. We are to seek the lost. In Matthew chapter 28, verse 19, go and make disciples. See, a church that is fulfilling its purpose, that's fulfilling what God wants, a church that God deems as faithful, is one that worships in spirit and truth, one that seeks the lost. And then also we see in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 20, to teach them, that is those that have been converted, to observe what God has commanded, that is to secure the saved. What's the work of the church? Worship God in spirit and truth, seek the lost, secure the saved. That's how God measures faithfulness. Well, let's look at our text for this morning. Philippians chapter 1 and in verse 27 through verse 30. Paul is addressing what is probably one of the closest relationships that he has with the congregation. The church at Philippi is a church that was begun on Paul's second missionary journey. In Acts chapter 16, Paul is there with Silas and with Timothy and with Luke. And they go out, and because there was no synagogue in that city, they go out by the river to pray, and they meet some women. And one of the women there obeys the gospel along with her household. You know her name. It's the name Lydia. And then a little bit while longer, as Paul is in that town, Paul and Silas offend some people because they cast a demon out of a girl that was bringing them profit and fortune telling. Paul casts that demon out, and him and Silas end up in jail. And while in jail, he interacts with another individual in what would be his household that evening, and that's the jailer. And so you have Lydia and her household, the jailer and his household, that are the beginnings of this congregation in Philippi. Now we jump forward through the rest of the second journey, through the third journey, Paul's arrest in Jerusalem, his detainment in Caesarea, his voyage to Rome. And so we're several years after the fact, and while imprisoned in Rome, he writes the book of Philippians. And as he writes this book, he's faced with a charge that could result in his death. He's faced with the possibility that he might be executed, that he might not return to Philippi. And in that, he writes this book, and in that book, we have this little small section. And then what we have is Paul encouraging them, these brethren, to be a faithful congregation. He says, beginning in verse 27, let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come or see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake, engage in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Paul says the very first word there is only. Whatever happens to Paul, whether he dies or he lives, he said that doesn't really matter. What matters is that you only do this, the things that are needful. And in so doing, he gives some attributes of a faithful congregation, a congregation that is doing the work of worshiping in spirit and truth, that is doing the work of seeking the lost, that is doing the work of securing the saved. And we might ask, why is this necessary? Travis, why are you talking about us this morning about this passage? Because there's a lot of things going on out in the world. A lot of those things could potentially affect the church. Can affect the message of the church, the work of the church. I think some of us were talking the other night, and I talked to Beth about this, and I've seen some things. People talk about, government is oppressing the church with restricting how many people go and mask mandates and all these kinds of things. And we're missing what's coming. We're missing a lot of things that are out in the world that are going to affect the church. Some of this equality stuff that is out there. Beth and I were talking about, 10 years ago, the worry was homosexuality, and that's still a worry. But in 10 years' time, now we're talking transgenderism. A whole bunch of other things that I don't understand, and I don't want to understand. They're going to affect the church. So the question is, are we going to be faithful to our task, our purpose, to worship, to seek the lost, to secure the saved? If we have the characteristics of a congregation that is faithful, then we will continue doing those works no matter what. Well, what are the characteristics that Paul mentions? The very first one, in verse 27, Paul says, only let your life or your manner of life be worthy. The word life there, in the English Standard Version, it's life. In the King James Version, it's conversation. In the New American Standard Version, it's conduct. Typically, when you have those words, life, conduct, conversation, there is a specific term that the New Testament uses, and that term is how you to walk each and every day. You walk this way day by day by day. But in this context, Paul uses a different word. In fact, this word is unique. It's only used one other time. In Acts chapter 23 and verse 1, Paul says, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience to this age. That's the only other time he used this word that we see, lived or life. So why does Paul choose this word, and what significance does it have? The word here for life, only let your manner of life, is the conduct and behavior of one who is a, here's the key, a citizen. A citizen. And the reason why Paul uses this term in this context is the city of Philippi was a Roman colony. And as a Roman colony, the people who made up this congregation, these Christians in Philippi, would understand in a very personal way what it meant to be a citizen. And as a citizen of Rome, then they would understand what Paul says in regards to being a citizen of heaven. Being a citizen of Rome had certain privileges and things that would go along with that, specifically in a colony. The colonies were interesting. The colonies were formed or allowed by Caesar to keep the peace, to guard against enemies approaching Rome. And so who do you think occupies the city that's a colony? This city in particular, Philippi. It's retired soldiers. Their military service policy was interesting. If you were going to serve, and you served well, and you served with honor, and you excelled in that, you had a retirement package. And your retirement package was you could go and you can live tax-free in certain cities, certain colonies. So this city of Philippi was a military, a retired military city. Well, what that allowed was for protection of Rome. Because if you look on a map, what you'll see is that Philippi sits along a road, sits along a path that goes from east to west, west being where Rome is. And so if a military is wanting to go from the east to attack Rome, they have to go right by cities like Philippi. And guess what Caesar has there? He has a retired army that's just sitting there ready to be called up at a moment's notice. And so he said, hey, you serve well, I'll give you the city tax-free. You'll be citizens. That has a whole number of privileges that go with it. And if I ever need you, I'll call you up to service again. It was a pretty good gig. It was a good situation for them. Now think about this. If you have a city that is formed with veteran soldiers that are granted citizenship, what that life would have been like? Yeah, they would have been privileged and thankful to be where they were. But these were people that served their country honorably for years. They're fanatical. They're loyal to Rome. And being loyal to Rome, what they did is they kept their language, they kept the titles, the customs, the dress. They refused to allow any outside influence coming in. That's what you see in this term when Paul says, let your manner of life, that is the life of a citizen, be worthy. Why? Because as you are a citizen of Rome, and you're grateful for Rome, and you're thankful for Rome, and you're fanatical about Rome, as Christians, you're citizens of heaven. And so what do? You speak the language of heaven, studying the word. Psalm 19, verse 14, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. You bear the title of heaven, just like they bore the titles of Rome. The title Christians. They were first called Christians in Antioch. You bear witness to the teachings. You go and you make disciples. This is what heaven calls us to do. You dressed as a citizen of heaven. We're not talking about physical apparel. We're talking about what Paul what Jesus mentioned in Romans chapter Revelation chapter 19, and that is that your garments are pure, that they're white. You allow no infiltration of worldly influence, even when society is going crazy around you and it is going into the depths of depravity. You stand blameless and innocent, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. What Paul tells them is, if you want to be faithful, you be faithful because you value your citizenship in heaven. But the second thing he says in verse 27 is that you also have a conduct that's worthy. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. A conduct that is worthy is one that is suitable to the gospel of Christ. It fits the gospel of Christ. It corresponds to it. As Christians, our behavior is to fit the gospel of Christ. We are to adorn the doctrine of Christ, Titus chapter 2 and verse 10. To not bring dishonor. Now, someone might ask the question, how is it that a Christian brings dishonor to the gospel? Is when by their lives, the Christian demonstrates that they don't believe what they profess. People that say, yeah, I'm a Christian, but then they turn around and they identify, they look like the world, they talk like the world, they think like the world, they act like the world. But they say, I'm a Christian. What happens? You have a credibility gap, don't you? You have that credibility gap. It's like, how is that possible? Christians have to have changed lives. And it's by our lives that we show and adorn the doctrine. By our lives and by the praise of our lives. But at the same time, it's not just the Christian's behavior that needs to be worthy, it's the congregation's behavior that needs to be worthy. How is that? By doing what the world sees congregation should be doing, or what God says? Matthew chapter 21, 23 through 27, by what authority do you do these things? Who gave you that authority? That's the question they asked Jesus. And Jesus said, I'll answer if you tell me the baptism of John. Did it come from heaven or from men? And what Jesus was establishing, what they understood that, was that you had to have the right authority from the right source in order to be pleasing. So they said, where did you get this authority, and what do you claim? If we're going to be a worthy congregation, if our conduct is going to be worthy, then we have to do all, whether as individuals or as a congregation, by or in the name of Christ. Paul says, this is what I want for the church of Philippi, only that you remember who you're citizens of, a country in heaven, and that you act in a way that is worthy. But notice also in verse 27, he goes on and it says, so that whether I come or and see you or am absent, I may hear that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. He says, I want you to have a conduct that is unified, that you stand firm. Now remember, Paul, he doesn't know if he's going to be released yet or if he's going to be executed. And if he's going to be executed, he wants the congregation of Philippi to know, you need to stand firm. Don't backpedal. Don't shy away from the truth. You stand firm. How? In unity. In one spirit and in one mind. That as Christians, you have one attitude, one purpose,
As Christians, you have one mind. That's one doctrine. People say, well, there's no way we can agree on everything. You're absolutely right. There's no way we're going to agree on everything. But we can agree on the things that we need to agree upon, can't we? In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 4 through 6, there are seven ones that are given. There's one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father who's above all, through all, and in all. That's just a few of them. Those are the things that we need to get to, that we need to agree on. If we can agree on the work of the church, the worship of the church, the plan of salvation, the Trinity, the deity, and we have the right attitude, that's unity. There's other things that we can have differences of opinion on. Romans chapter 14 characterizes some of those things. But we can have unity and be of one mind in the doctrine that we are called to have. So while the world may be split, the world may be divided, the way the world may be arguing, and the world might be differing with each other, they might be fussing or feuding or fighting, the Lord's church is to be unified. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 10. Paul says, I appeal to you that there be no divisions among you. Ephesians 4, and verse 3, eager to maintain the unity of spirit and the bond of peace. To stand firm in unity, and to stand firm, he goes on, for the faith of the gospel. Working together with the one doctrine, with the one attitude, for the one purpose, exerting energy. And the last characteristic of a faithful congregation, verse 28 through 30, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. Being a Christian in today's world is not easy. But can I suggest to you that being a Christian in the first century church world would not have been easy as well? The level of depravity that Rome had within its empire, probably not far off from where we're at. The fact that they would persecute Christians and put Christians to death, that's pretty severe. To not have, as a Christian, to not have any support outside the church or friendships outside the church because the Jews hated the Christians and the Gentiles hated the Christians. It was not easy. But what is it Paul says? And not frightened in anything. Don't be afraid. Don't be fearful. Why? Look further in verse 28. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction. The way the world is going, their persecution of Christians, he says, is a sign they're going to be destroyed. How's that work? Because you can take away everything a Christian has, and a Christian will still have something that you can't get to. You can persecute a church to a level that drives the church underground, but there's something that they have that there is no way that you're going to be able to conquer or overtake. What that shows is, no matter what, Christians will be victorious. What do we have? We have hope. You could take away every possession that we have, and we still have more than the world offers because we have Christ. What that shows is we're going to be saved, and the world's going to be destroyed. He goes on and says, a persecution is a sign of our salvation. Verse 28 is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. Why is it a sign of my salvation? Because all that desire to live godly in Christ Jesus, 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, will be persecuted. It's just going to happen. Persecution is a privilege. We might not look at it that way. We might not appreciate it that way. But why are we persecuted? Verse 29, for it's been granted to you for the sake of Christ that you should not only believe
in him, but also suffer for his sake. Why do you suffer as a Christian?
We're persecuted. Not because of some insignificant individual. Not because of someone that we should be ashamed of.
Persecuted because we follow Christ. What Jesus said in John chapter 15 is, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And the last thing Paul says about courageous conduct is, persecution, whatever the world throws your way, can be endured. And he guarantees that in verse 30 by saying, engage in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Paul says, if you want someone to look to, look to me. I've endured persecution. As Paul writes this, he's been shipwrecked, he's been beat, he's been stoned, he's been left for dead, he's been arrested, he's been in prison for a number of years at this point in time. And he continues to be faithful. Why? Because for Paul, there is nothing more valuable than Christ. And he was willing to suffer anything for it. When we look at the world, the way the world is going, yeah, there's a lot out there that is not good. I'm not surprised. You take God out of man's thinking, and that's what happens. So if we're not surprised, then what do we need to do? Just keep doing the work. That's what we need to do. Keep doing the work. What's the work? Worship God in spirit and truth. Seek the lost, secure the saved. That's our work. And as individuals, to be a light. Why should I do that when everything around me seems to be going bad? Because I'm a citizen of heaven. That's why I do it. Because I want my life to be something that gospel creates, that's worthy of the sacrifice Christ made. To stand together with people like Faith and to be courageous, because God's not going to abandon his work. He's not going to say, sorry, work's done. The world's gone horribly wrong. He's not going to do that. Now, what he's going to do is, at some point, he's going to bring judgment. And at that point in time, whose side do you want to be on? I want to be on the Lord's side. A lot of things going on right now. I just, be honest, I'm not shocked. Sometimes I get a little worried. Not for my sake. I get worried when I look at my kids and their future kids, what they're going to have to face. But in the end, I know that the Lord is going to take care of those that are his. So our responsibility is to be faithful, be a light. Because we're not going to convert people to the world, to a way of the world that will make them happy here, I don't think. I think we teach and we proclaim the gospel so people have some hope of something better. That's what we look forward to. So we end this morning with an opportunity, if there's someone that needs to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sometimes preachers are accused of being like used car salesmen. I just want you to know, there's nothing as valuable as Christ. You can test him, and he will always be faithful. The price, he's already paid it. The question is, are you going to accept it? If you're going to accept it to become a Christian, you got to be baptized. Change your life. Confess his name. And in the end, you won't have a lemon. You'll have a gem. He is our Savior. If there's someone who needs to obey the gospel, why not come forward while I stand and sing the song?
Have thine affection.